Let's call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:33 p.m. on Tuesday, April 5th, 2016. Present with us today, we have Representative Wilson, Representative Guerra, Representative Kawasaki, Vice Chair Sadler, myself, Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Newman, Representative Munoz, Representative Edgman, Representative Gaddis, and Representative Guttenberg. And with that, please make sure your cell phones are off. No electronic devices allowed during committee. On today's schedule, we have House Bill 245, Permanent Fund, Deposit, Dividends, and Earnings. We will focus on the Governor's Bill, House Bill 245, by House rules by request of the Governor. The administration's consultant, the McKinsey Group, will provide us with a presentation called Ensuring a Sound Fiscal Future. Here to provide testimony on behalf of the McKinsey Group is Mr. Martin Bailey, an economist and currently a senior fellow with the Brookings Institute. Commissioner Hoffbeck from the Department of Revenue will introduce Mr. Bailey to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue. And I just wanted to just make a couple real brief statements and then introduce Martin Bailey. The as we put together the Permanent Fund Protection Act this year and really looked at how we could use our earnings in a sustainable and robust fashion, we probably spent over 6 months modeling and testing various ways to use the our earnings reserve. And but when we finally landed on a package that we thought was robust and sustainable, we thought this is a critical piece of legislation. And I mean, it's probably as important as any piece of legislation that's been introduced since probably when the Permanent Fund was first established. And we thought we need to bring in a third party expert to vet the work that we had done internally within the Department of Revenue to make sure that in fact it was a robust model. We put out an RFP. McKinsey and Company was selected as the contractor to do the work to vet the model. And they were selected primarily because they're an internationally known company that does this kind of work. They're a global management consulting firm working with businesses and governments, nonprofits, and institutional investors worldwide. And in the last 5 years, they've supported more than 300 public finance projects in over 35 countries. They're leading advisor for institutional investors, including sovereign wealth funds, and that was one of the critical things that we wanted to look at, and U.S. state pension funds. They've also advised other petrol-rich companies, countries in looking at sustainable use models for their wealth as well. So they have background in this. They built models to look at these kind of things, and they were the most logical contractor to use to take a look at this. So today, Martin Bailey will do the presentation on behalf of the McKinsey and Company. Martin is a senior fellow and holds the Bernard L. Schwartz Chair of Economic Policy Development at the Brookings Institute in Washington. His primary areas of focus of study has been in economic growth, financial regulation, and monetary and fiscal policy. And he sits on the board of the Phoenix Companies in Hartford, Connecticut, where he serves as chairman of the Finance and Investment Committee. Dr. Bailey served as the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors from 1999 to 2001. He's a PhD in economics from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and has taught at MIT, Yale, and the University of Maryland. Again, author of many books and articles. And he's currently an external advisor to McKinsey, and he's been asked to provide expert input on the fact-based assessment of the financial model that was built by the Department of Revenue for use of using the earnings reserve as part of Alaska Permanent Fund Protection Act. So with that, I would invite Dr. Bailey to come forward.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner Hoffbeck. And also we have Attorney General Richards here to answer questions. Mr. Bailey, if you want to place yourself on the record, and we will hear you and see your presentation and probably hold questions till we get through it to the end so we can come back then. So please note your question.
That would be great, however you want to do it. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to testify today. So I'm going to present what we think is an objective assessment.
You will place yourself on the record for us, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm not experienced right. with the niceties here. So I should. What should I say?
We'll just say.
Place myself on the record. I know. You can laugh at me. That's all right.
Our secretary just likes to have your voice.
Have my name. Okay. My name is Martin Bailey.
Thank you. Continue.
Continue. Okay. I'm off to a good start here. So this is the model that was built by the Department of Revenue to test the viability of the proposed drawing from the earnings reserve. This is outlined in the Alaska Permanent Fund Protection Act, and the work was done by McKinsey & Company, and I worked on it with McKinsey & Company. So I'm going to start with an overview of what's included in my presentation, and then we'll go into more details as we go on. I think first it's important just to review the Act itself and what it does. So under the current system, production taxes and royalties largely go into the general fund for year-to-year spending. Under this legislation, production taxes and half of royalties would be put into the permanent fund and withdraw the amount that the model determines to be sustainable for the general fund, for general fund spending. So that instead of having the ups and downs of oil prices reflected in spending, we have a stable draw and thereby stabilize general fund expenditures. The dividend is currently half of realized earnings. Under the proposal, the dividend would be half of annual royalties. So the principal purpose of this act is to improve budget stability and de-link spending from volatile oil prices and volatile investment returns. So I want to pause there for a moment. That's really the whole idea of building what is, you know, in a sense a somewhat complex model, but it's trying to achieve a complex task, really, or a difficult task, I should say, and that is to take the very uncertain earnings that come in, revenues that come into the state budget, and try to translate that into stable allowance for spending. So the Department of Revenue undertook an extensive exercise to use a financial model to determine how large an amount could be sustainably drawn, that is, how much the state could draw and expect that the fund value will be maintained and the earnings reserve will be sufficient. That can be revisited on a four-year basis, so every 4 years, and that gives additional confidence in the sustainability of the plan. In other words, you can look every 4 years, make sure you haven't gone off track, and whether you want to make some corrections. And as was said, that the state sought an independent review, and that was done by McKinsey and myself. If we turn to slide 3. So now let me talk about the sort of overview of the conclusions that we got from this assessment. Again, this is the overview, so we go into more details on each of these elements to the extent that it's helpful to do so. First, we found that the Department of Revenue's model is sound in its methodology and in its use of Monte Carlo probabilistic modeling. Monte Carlo modeling means that you take variables that are uncertain and you look at the range of possibilities each of them could have. So what do we think oil prices might be? They might be low, they could be in the middle, they could be high. So there's a lot of uncertainty. We try to map that uncertainty. The same for earnings. They could be high and low. And we use this probabilistic modeling to say, okay, how can we capture, we can't dismiss it because it's there, it's just out there, oil prices vary, earnings go up and down. That how do we sort of capture this in a way that can be brought within the scope of budget modeling so that we can get something that we can get our hands around that's more stable. The second thing, the assumptions were deemed to be reasonable when we validated them against third-party sources. So it says here the assumptions are reasonable. What that means is we looked at what assumptions were put into the model and then said, okay, let's see what other people that are looking at oil prices, that are looking at investment returns, what do they say about these things? And we judge that these were reasonable. We turn to page 5. So this is just a word about the scope of this presentation, this discussion, the scope of the work that was done. So it was a detailed review and vetting of the DOR's financial model methodology and construction, and whether we thought it was appropriate to use Monte Carlo approaches. Second, we looked at the reasonableness of the assumptions, oil prices, oil production, investment returns, and that affect the sustainable draw. And thirdly, we did examine best practices of sovereign wealth funds and other kinds of funds as well, but predominantly sovereign wealth funds, how they manage their funds. How do they draw out? How do they maintain? Do they look at long-term investment returns or short-term investment returns? Try to understand what are sort of the best practices either here in the United States or in other countries. How do they handle sovereign wealth funds? The things on the right are the things that we don't do. So it is not my task or McKinsey's task to say what the policy should be. That is obviously for the people's representatives to say. We're not trying to look at the budget or the budget deficit or say whether there should be more or less. This is to evaluate a particular proposal and the model that is used behind that proposal. We didn't look at different tax regimes, if the taxes were changed on petroleum or other aspects like this. And there are a couple of other things that we mentioned that we don't look at. But I do want to be careful in making clear what it is that we are focused on, which is the validity of the model, its assumptions, how it works, does it do what it says it's going to do. Can we turn to slide six? So this is just a quick review of three sovereign wealth funds, Singapore, Kazakhstan, and Norway. And these are funds that have been able to develop pretty disciplined savings and spending rules that have allowed them to invest for the long term. So let me say a little bit more about them. They're all different. They're not necessarily that this set of rules would work for Alaska, but it is helpful to see what other countries do and how it's worked out for them or whether they've gotten into trouble and whether it's achieved the goals that they wanted. So Singapore has been a very disciplined saving economy, and they have set up a substantial sovereign wealth fund or pension fund, and they have set the rules that they're allowed to spend 50% of the annualized 20-year expected return. So they don't just spend the year-by-year returns. They look at what they think returns are likely to be over 20 years, and they've been very good at investing, as a matter of fact. So this gives a fair amount of flexibility on a year-to-year basis, but it caps the outflows at a low enough level to make sure they continue the growth of their corpus, their wealth fund. National Fund of Kazakhstan, now that's a country that's had its difficulties. They've spent too much, gotten themselves in trouble, but they had, under 2010 reforms, they set out an annual draw that they fixed at $8 billion. This was used to reduce budget deficits and for economic development, because aside from oil, Kazakhstan is a relatively underdeveloped country. The government is allowed under their rules to adjust the annual draw by up to 15%, as they did. And also, if the balance of the fund, if the corpus of the fund, in other words, drops below 20% of GDP, which is the figure they take as the level of the fund they would like to have, then they have to work their way back up again. They have to manage the budget so they can build that back up again. Norway is one of the most respected sovereign wealth funds. It's a little bit more conservative than some others in its investment. As you know, they discovered oil in the North Sea, and they wanted to preserve that to create a sovereign wealth fund for their whole population and for future generations. So in a way, quite similar to the situation that Alaska has. So what they do is they limit government non-oil deficits. That's to say they have a budget deficit, revenues from other places, and Norway has pretty high taxes. So they have taxes coming in and spending going out, and there's a limit of 4% of their GDP is the budget deficit they can run just on the basis of the taxes coming in and the expenditures going out. And then they make up this deficit by drawing from the pension fund. But this rule, this 4% rule, means that they can't overdraw from this. They can draw a little bit extra if their investment funds make extra money, But it's capped. It's very carefully constrained. So again, all three of these sovereign wealth funds have disciplined savings and spending rules that have served them well. It means that they've had stable funds, they've been able to help fund their budgets, and in the case of Kazakhstan, their economic development, without undermining the fund and keeping that fund for the posterity of their population. Let's look at slide 7. So now let's turn more specifically to what the proposal here is in the Act, and how the model is constructed and what we did around the model. So obviously this model starts by saying, what are the inflows to the fund? You know what they are: production tax revenues, royalty revenues, and investment returns. And all three are important at different times. One or other has been more important. At the moment, the investment returns are larger than some of the oil revenues. That's obviously not been true at other times. So we then look at what are those going to be in the future. Can we forecast not exactly what they're going to be, but what is the range of values that they're going to have, and sort of what's the sort of mean or median and the distribution around those if they're uncertain. So again, that's oil production, obviously, is going to determine some of the tax revenues and the royalty revenues. The price of oil is very important and is sort of nonlinear in the sense that if the price of oil is very high, then the amount of money that comes into the state is very large. You get a very good flow of money coming into the state budget. If the oil price drops below a certain point, it really falls off very drastically. So it sort of curves up, and then when the oil price goes down, there's very little coming in from the oil source. Then the third part here is, okay, so based on the inflows, based on the projections that we're going to use about the variables that we think are deterministic, that we can make a good sense of what they are, those that are variable, that fluctuate a lot from year to year, where we're going to use this probabilistic approach. We then say, what's the sustainable draw amount that can be taken looking over the long run that will still give us a 50% confidence that the real value of the starting assets is preserved over time, so that the corpus of the fund is maintained? Okay, so that's obviously a key element. And then the second element is the earnings reserve. That's the part where the actual draw is taken from, and that has to be sustainable. That has to have enough cash to actually pay the draw that you have in the plan. Slide 8. Now, the next step is a little bit complicated, and it's meant to be just kind of illustrative of what's going on here, and I'd like to try to boil it down and talk about how you actually put a Monte Carlo model together, because I know that's not the most obvious or common thing that you run into. All right, so as we said in step one from the previous page, we have to understand what are the revenue drivers coming into the model as they come into the state in terms of the restricted and unrestricted revenue sources. So obviously we have to distinguish between the total returns on the investment and the part that's available to go into the earnings reserve. So these we try to understand, and again, understand how variable they are, what are the distributions around them. Thirdly, we look at what the impact of these drivers is on the cash flows. And then we put it together and build this probabilistic model, this so-called Monte Carlo model. I'm going to say more about that as we move forward. But obviously we have to understand what's the impact of these variable revenue flows into the fund and earnings reserve, and how that money is available for the annual draw. Move to slide 8. This is an illustrative chart. It illustrates the fact that McKinsey has evaluated any number of funds of different kinds. Some of them are run by banks, some of them are run by pension funds, many of them are sovereign wealth funds. I had a list of three earlier. There are many others around the world. McKinsey works extensively with these kinds of programs to try and assess whether they have constructed a good plan for keep putting the money in, preserving the fund, but taking money out to whatever use is for, to pay pensions if it's a pension fund, to help the budget if it's the Norwegian fund, and so on. So we take a look at the assumptions that are made. We take a look at the methodology they've used, how they've approached it. And as you can see at the bottom, these are the five sort of ingredients, the oil revenues, the investment returns, the structure of the model. Is the model that's been put together to help work with these variable cash inflows, does it have a logic? Are the conceptual are the concepts sound? And what's the process by which it's determined whether or not a given draw is sustainable? So that's the process that McKinsey did, and I do want to emphasize that this is something that's been done many times before. Of course, your situation is unique and has to be treated in a unique way, but it's not something that some of the characteristics of it, some of the features of it, are things that we've seen before and that we have some experience in modeling and understanding. We turn to slide 11. So now this is the first slide that actually lays out some of the results of the model. What does the model actually say? And the first piece of the results is to look at the earnings reserve each year. And that, of course, there has to be enough money in the earnings reserve. If you are going to take $3.3 billion annual draw, then there has to be enough money in the earnings reserve each year. And what we did through this Monte Carlo process was model what if you were doing this process all the way through to 2040, what would be the cumulative probability of succeeding or failing? And as you can see, in the early years, that probability is essentially 100%. So for the first 5 years, 6 years, it is essentially 100%. So this assumes that we're starting with $10 billion in the earnings reserve. And we're drawing out $3.3 billion. There's money coming into the earnings reserve from the section part of the oil revenues, and then the statutory earnings are coming into the earnings reserve. So there's money coming in, and then the $3.3 billion that's going out, and we're starting with $10 billion. So it's perhaps not surprising, but it's comforting to see that for the first 5 or 6 years, you pretty much guaranteed that there will be enough money in that fund. And let me point out that even though the earnings returns are variable, as you know, markets go up and down a lot, you get a lot of variability in earnings, the portfolio does have in it some assets that are relatively stable, bonds and real estate that yield rents. So there is a fairly stable basis for that money that comes into the earnings reserve, even if markets are going through a particularly difficult year. And so that's, again, another reason why we can be confident that it's essentially 100% probability, or it's virtually certain. It starts to fall off, but it's still very high. 2027 is still 95% probability, and it then starts to fall off. Well, what does that mean? And you could look at this number at the end, 69%, and say, well, wait a minute, does that mean that there's about a little bit less than one-third chance that we might run out of money in the earnings reserve? Well, in a sense, yes. But keep in mind that this is really what the model says would happen if you put everything on autopilot. So you don't make any corrections. You just say, okay, right, we're going to do this, and we're going to let it run and draw $3.3 billion with some inflation adjustment all the way out to 2040, and we're not even going to worry about what's going on. That's the situation that says a cumulative probability, you might get a failure by 2040. But within this model is the provision that every 4 years you're able to do a periodic review. So you stop and say, okay, we put in some assumptions into this model about the distribution of oil prices or the distribution of earnings. Do we need to revisit those in the light of what we've seen over the past 4 years? We've said that we're going to draw $3.3 billion. Does that turn out to be about the right amount, or is that something where we would need to manage down that amount, perhaps gradually over time, in order to protect the fact that the earnings reserve has to have enough money? So I think when we look at this chart, we say, hey, this is good news. We've got essentially 100% probability for the first 5, 10, even longer years that there'll be enough money in the earnings reserve. When we know that if things go a little bit different, they don't go as well as we had hoped or as the distributions here were predicting, then we need to take corrective action. So let's look at slide 11. Now, this is the second important output from the model, and it lays out the predicted path and the variation around that path for the permanent fund. So the DOR model predicts that the permanent fund, the median value, so the most likely value, or the 50% more, 50% less value that the permanent fund will have in 2040, again, assuming the whole thing is on autopilot, will be $96 billion, and that preserves the real value of the permanent fund. There's an assumption here in running these numbers that inflation is 2.25%. So obviously, to preserve the real value of the permanent fund, you'd have to have the actual value and nominal value rising over time. Now, you can see as you look at this chart that there's quite a few options on the upside. So at the 75th percentile, there's quite a good probability you might get even as high as $196 billion. That's not what you'd want to bank on, but it's certainly within the bounds of what's possible. The more difficult situation would be on the downside. So on the downside, you would fall below the value that you need to preserve the permanent fund. So again, under those circumstances, you would need to readjust the draw in order to make sure that you preserve the permanent fund going forward. And again, that's another indication that this chart or this model just kind of runs on autopilot until 2040. You would have the option under the Act to make this review and make sure that you didn't undermine the fund. So now, starting on slide 14, I'm going to review. So far, I've basically been talking about what the model does and what the assumptions were and a little bit about how it was put together. Now we're going to talk about the assessment that was done. So how did McKinsey look at this and decide whether we thought it was a valid model or not? So we assessed the assumptions that were made and compared them with objective third-party sources. So we looked at what was being assumed about oil production, what was being assumed about oil prices, both the mean and the variation, the uncertainty around oil prices. Did that distribution make sense? Was it one that we felt comfortable with? And the answer was yes. We tested it against third-party sources. Similarly, for the other variables that were put into the model. We also assessed the methodology that was used, and that's the use of the Monte Carlo. And again, I'm going to skip that a little bit. I'll say more about what's behind that. But I will say here that from our perspective, trying to do this kind of planning for your budget, for your sovereign wealth fund, in the presence of really very wide uncertainty in the cash flows that are coming in, using a Monte Carlo analysis is really best practice. It's used in a lot of cases. It's a methodology that's been developed a lot. It's in a Microsoft software. You can run it. It's a fairly standard tool to try to do planning, private sector or public sector planning, when you have a lot of uncertainty that you're facing and that you have to find a way of dealing with it. Now, along the way, this was an interactive process. So when McKinsey was first brought in, we worked with DOR to make some changes. None of the changes that we demanded were massive, but some of them were we felt important. and the Department of Revenue was very responsive and made the changes that we felt needed to be made in order to make this a better model. Now, is it an absolutely perfect model? No, these models never are, but what we do say, it's a very good model, it does the job, but we do provide an agenda that potentially there could be future improvements that could fine-tune it and make it a little even better going forward. Let's turn to slide 15. So now, again, we're sort of drilling down a little bit into these same ingredients. So the four critical drivers that determine the revenues that come in, which are the price of crude, how much oil is produced, the total returns, and the statutory returns on the fund. Okay. So here we assessed, and I don't know if I need to go through all of them, although we can. For the crude price, for example, we looked at external third parties, WoodMac and Rystad, pretty standard sources that one goes to for an assessment of price of crude. For total and statutory returns, we again looked at third-party projections, and we also spoke with investors at the permanent fund, you know, because obviously the returns that are being projected depend also on the asset allocation in the model, how much of different kinds of assets are actually in the permanent fund. And so we talked to the permanent fund investors to give ourselves a better understanding of what their strategy was and projections for that fund performance. If we turn to slide 16, now I'm going to do why deterministic and why probabilistic for Monte Carlo. So where you do deterministic projection, so you would sort of say, this is what I think let's do it for oil production. What do we think oil production is going to be over the next 10 years and the next 20 years? Now, we don't know the answer to that, but that's not a variable that sort of varies wildly from year to year the way the oil price does, and it's not like the returns on investment are. It's a fairly steady flow, and it may grow a little, it may shrink a little. We took the assumption that this was a deterministic variable, so this was something we would just make a forecast of what oil production was going to be. Now, the forecast that was built into the model was actually pretty conservative. It shows oil production going down over time. So it's falling oil production. Now, we know that that's likely to be the case in Alaska, but, you know, circumstances could change. There could be something that comes along that provides a new source of oil. That was not built into this model. So this assumption is definitely on the conservative side, with gradually declining oil production. Now the probabilistic or Monte Carlo variables. Okay, so what the model does is it uses the ability of computers to run a lot of different possible outcomes. So what you say for, let's say, the oil price, we've got a distribution, so the oil price could be as high as, I think it went up to 150, it would have gone down to 30, so we've got a distribution, and that is to say, how likely do we think it is that the oil price is going to be 30 or 35 or 50 or 100 or even 150 in the extreme case? So that's the distribution that's fed in. So what the model does is say, okay, we're going to pick an outcome, and with each time we run this model, we make a pick from the probability distribution. So when we've finished and we run 10,000 different runs of this model, we have a picture of what will happen under a whole range of possibilities for oil prices. We say we don't know what's going to be. It could be in this range, but by repeating over and over again, we were able to get a pretty good sense of what the different possible outcomes would be under the DOR model with different prices of oil. The same with earnings returns. Earnings returns vary a lot. The returns on the permanent fund have been good and have only been negative a few times. Statutory returns, I think, have only been negative once in the record we had going back, not quite to the start of the fund. So, but still, they are uncertain, and we know, as in 2008-09, we had a recession and we had a year of very negative returns. Actually, it was only 1 year in the permanent fund. So again, we're trying to find a way of managing that uncertainty. So why do we use this strange computerized model to do that? Well, because the uncertainty is really out there. It's not something that we've imposed or some just complexity we're looking at for the sake of looking at it. It's the fact that those prices are uncertain and we don't know what they're going to be. So how do we manage and make decisions, and in particular, how do we achieve the goal of having a stable budget when we're facing so much uncertainty? And this Monte Carlo approach is a way of doing that. It tells you what those probability distributions are going to be, and you saw the results earlier. So we think there's a nearly 100% probability, even with the uncertainty, that the earnings reserve will not be depleted. We think there's the median outcome, the most likely outcome, is that the permanent fund will be preserved, and there's a strong probability that actually it will rise very substantially. So this is a way of using this technique, this Monte Carlo technique, of being able to manage the uncertainty that's intrinsic to the process we're dealing with, the variable oil prices and variable returns on investment. So that's why we picked the deterministic outcome for oil prices, because it's not a year-to-year bouncing around variable, and why we did Monte Carlo for those variables who are just a great deal of variability inside them. So let's look at 17, and again, this is not one I want to go into a lot of detail, but I think it's meant to illustrate really the kind of depth and care with which McKinsey evaluated this model. This was not some quick hit and run. We looked very carefully at were there errors in this model? Did they use a single source to find a particular number, or were they checking their numbers? How did they calculate the inputs to the model? Where did they decide to use Monte Carlo? And where did they decide to use deterministic? Did they use the right probabilistic model, the right Monte Carlo model? And is this a repeatable and consistent process? Now, we believe on the basis of this assessment, as I said at the outset, that this is, we found this to be a sound model and the assumptions to be reasonable. We did say there were a couple places where maybe we thought there could be, particularly if this model is being used help future budget processes, that the things might be improved a little bit. You need to make sure who actually owns the model, who's running it, who's responsible, who makes sure that the numbers are checked so that each time you run the model. Am I not being heard? I thought I was talking too loudly. Sorry. To make sure that whoever is owning the model can be responsible for it and be accountable for it and make sure that it's done right. Let's turn to page 18. So this again lays out the variable, the probabilistic variables, the crude selling price, the total return rate, and the statutory net income rate, and the production volume. And it describes how we checked them, what was the rationale for using them here. So this was based on a process where you ask different experts what they think oil prices are going to be, and you try to find their answer about what's the 10% probability that it'll be above this level, and that was $31. What's about the median value you expect to get? What's the value you think's about to be more likely to be above and more likely but to be below? And that was $56. And then the 90th percentile, so what's the variable such that you think there's only a 10% probability that the oil price would be higher than 87? So that was what was done, working with the group at DOR, the ERG group at DOR, and looking for outside experts to make this assessment. The deterministic model was again constructed. Not much volatility there, so that was taken to be a straight line. And with the returns, they used the 6.9% mean rate, 13.9 standard deviation for total returns. So that's pretty variable. They used a normal distribution, so that varies a lot over time. And that again can be checked objectively from outside sources, and it is a method that's been developed by Cowan, which is the advisor to the permanent fund. And similarly for the statutory net income, that one's a little bit more difficult to check with outside sources because it depends upon the particular state provisions about how much of the return actually goes into the earnings reserve and how much remains in the permanent fund. But again, this was based on Cowan's calculations, and they have been working with the fund for a number of years. If we look at the slide 19, these are some of the recommendations that we made some suggested changes, and changes were made in response to what McKinsey suggested. In particular, the early versions of the model, they did have estimates on the earnings reserve and on the corpus, the permanent fund, but they weren't integrated projections. It wasn't done all together, and it needed to be done in an integrated way because those two are so closely connected with each other. So that was done in the reformulation of the model. We also wanted to get a little bit more information from Cowan about how they were constructing these returns and get a better view of what would be the right distribution of returns to use in the model. And that was done also. We got more information from them. So there were changes that were requested, and these changes were made, and it was a very flexible and process that improved, I think, the quality of the model. If we turn to page 20, I think I've gotten a little ahead of myself because I've been talking about verifying some of these estimates, and this is actually a page that talks about that, so I will try not to recap too much. But as I said, the oil price is roughly in line with third-party estimates, and Rystad and WoodMac are two very standard sources. The crude production does not assume, I mentioned it was conservative, it does not assume new projects coming online unless there's money or permission behind. It's basically the production that's currently in place. And again, the total returns mean variance model, that one was, we were able to check it from Goldman Sachs, Bridgewater, and AQR, three of the leading funds. And then the statutory returns, as I think I said earlier, that's a 10-year estimate, and that has to take into account the specific determinants of what go into statutory returns as opposed to net returns. If we turn to page 21. So this is a little bit more about the agenda for future improvements that could be made. And these are particularly if there are changes that are made to the system. So, for example, if the investment fund's mandate were changed and it were to have a different investment strategy, then they might have a different asset allocation, and we would want to look at the returns and see if they were appropriate to the new asset allocation in the fund. If there were new tax policies, that would be a change that would have to be incorporated. If there were new liquidity constraints, and that's an important factor, obviously there has to be, in order to make the draw that goes to support the state spending, there has to be liquid assets that can be realized in a way that does not undermine their value. So those things would have to be changed if there were changes made. That basically concludes my slides and the slide presentation. I just want to say, in conclusion, I want to sort of reiterate. As we saw it, the Department of Revenue's plan was designed to tackle volatile revenues, earnings, returns, and petroleum, and try to translate them or manage them in a way that the state could have a stable draw for state spending. That is the principal goal that was being looked for, to avoid very large ups and downs in the state budget. The second was to make sure there was a rules-based framework consistent with best practices for the management of the permanent fund. So it is preserved in perpetuity for the people of Alaska, and there are clear rules about how the money is drawn and how the funds flow into that. We took a look, as I said, at the model itself. Does this model make sense? Is Monte Carlo the right thing to use? What are the assumptions that go into it? And we found that those, both the model itself, the methodology, and the assumptions, we felt were sound. In other words, McKinsey found that the model does what it says it does. And let me conclude on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bailey.
Mr. Bailey, if right now there's approximately $6.2 billion or so in a CBR, 7 or so in earnings reserve, all of your modeling assumes that there would be a $3 billion or so transfer from earnings reserve from the constitutional budget reserve, the CBR, into the earnings reserve to bring that up to $10
billion. Yes, it does.
Thank you. So what if that transfer was not done? What if we stayed at $7 billion? What does that do to your model? And if you modeled it at different numbers, 7, 8, 9, and $10 billion?
We looked at the model assuming there was $10 billion in the earnings reserve, and I think the model could be run with different numbers, and that can be done. The model we looked at had the $10 billion. I can certainly tell you that if there were $7 billion rather than $10 billion, that would mean that the probability that the earnings reserve might be exhausted, that would go up. So you wouldn't stay at 100% quite as long. It would be fewer years, a shorter year by a year or so, that you would have that 100% confidence. You would also have to reduce the amount of the draw in order to make the model sustainable in the long run if you started with the smaller amount. But again, let me reiterate, you know, the model would still run, and you would still have the provision that you could make every 4 years, you could make that adjustment. So it's not like, even with $7 billion, that it would just break down right off. But as I said, it would require, if it were to be sustainable over the very long run, that you would have to make adjustments.
Thank you, Mr. Bailey. On that, so your model assumes that there's a $10 billion in the earnings reserve. Is your model based solely on the $10 billion in the earnings reserve at 6.9% to spend off $3.3 billion per year?
Yes.
It does not include any of the baseline of the permanent fund itself, only the $10 billion in the ER?
That's my understanding, Congressman, yes.
Does the volatility within the permanent fund dividend, it's about $50 billion now. It was prior to that, I believe 54, maybe in 55 earlier this year. Does that affect your, how did you play that into your Monte Carlo assessments on the payback of a 3.3 assessment that you're almost 100% sure of?
Well, the model we ran was as said, but let me ask Randy if you want to comment on that, because I think you've had the opportunity to look at some of those issues.
Chair, for the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue. Yeah, we did look at several things, that questions that you've just brought up. Going back to your prior question, what the effect of the $3 billion, if we didn't have the $3 billion draw. And we've got some additional modeling that we'll present or give to the chair to pass out to the board. But it reduced the draw by about $150 million a year if you don't have that $3 billion in there. You come off plateau maybe a year or two earlier off the 100% confidence if with that reduced draw. And your total uncertainty in the year 2040 is 2, 3, 4% different than if the transfer has been made. So it does impact in two ways. One, it does reduce your confidence a little, not very much. and it does reduce your draw by about $150 million. Going to the 6.9% return, I'm not sure whether the question is based on some of the recent information that the permanent fund has put out or what they...
I'll get to that.
Okay. I can discuss that right now as long as I'm on record. The permanent fund put out a report a few weeks ago that indicated that their long-term, their 10-year forecast had dropped from 6.9 to 5.8%. We asked for additional information from Callan on that so we could understand the basis of that. And that was their forecast for FY16 to FY25. And it was done at the end of January when the markets had dropped dramatically. They were down in the high 40, $48, $49 million was the value of the fund at the time. So they had factored in that 7 months of low returns into their 10-year forecast and had reduced their 10-year forecast based on that 1 year of low revenue. But the other 9 years were still at the 6.9%. And, in fact, the last 5 months of their analysis, they had 7 months of low returns, but they actually used their long-term return rate for the last 5 months in doing that analysis. So it really wasn't, it didn't change their long-term forecast. It was just recognizing that in the period from FY16 to 25, they had to recognize that lower rate of return on the investments. Since that time, the market's recovered. And as of today, the value of the fund is about $53 million. So it's come back up about 10%. And that really kind of points to the fact that one of the reasons why you don't want to start chasing returns up and down, why you want to use this Monte Carlo system that allows for variable returns through the life of the modeling. And what it also did is that really puts our baseline, which in our model, our baseline was that there would be $52 million in the fund on July 1, 2016, after paying the dividend. We have about $53 million in there right now, so we'll be just about dead on that baseline that went into the model. And if you look at Callan's forecast for FY17 to FY26, that 10-year period, it's still the 6.9%. So nothing is really different from what we have modeled based on that one short-term report that Callan put out.
Thank you, Commissioner. So if you can spin off $3.3 billion at assuming 6.69% out of the $10 billion, theoretically, if you just had a $10 billion fund there, so we're to understand that the permanent fund will spin off $3.3 billion in revenue each year to replenish the earnings reserve where that money is brought out each year?
Chairman Newman, it's the combination of the earnings from the permanent fund and the oil and gas taxes and royalties, which are also fed into the permanent fund earnings reserve in our model. So it's oil and gas revenues plus investment returns can give you $3.3 billion a year.
Thank you, Commissioner. Is that oil and gas returns calculated on what the governor's new assumptions for House Bill 247 or the oil and gas returns or investments that way?
Chairman Newman, that used the probabilistic modeling, which had a range of prices from that even at the lower prices that are in the revenue sources book for the spring update still fall within the range of the probabilistic modeling. And so there's no change in the assumptions. But the model quite simply assumes that there's going to be low years and high years, and this just happens to be one of the low years. But it's still within the range that the model forecasts.
We'll let others ask some questions here. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on Representative Newman's question, in the beginning of the year when this was presented to us, the department was projecting oil prices in the $70 range and then going up, and the most recent one has oil prices projected in the $40 range and never really getting past 70. How does that not affect the amount coming out of the new sovereign wealth fund? How can it still be $3.3 billion when when that average price has changed by about $20 a barrel.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra. You've got two different processes that are occurring. Within the sovereign wealth modeling, we use the probabilistic modeling. We look at it, there'll be a range of prices throughout the life of the model. For purposes of the revenue sources book, we have to give you a deterministic number. We have to give you a set data point each year because you can't really budget on a range. You need to budget based on a specific price. And so in putting out the spring update, we actually looked at what the current price of oil was and tied our forecast for purposes of the revenue sources book to the current price right now, which is at a lower point in the range, but it's going to take a while for it to recover from there. And so we had to pick a specific data point. The model itself allows for variable data points each year.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. I guess the question is, if you use the prices that are in your 10-year forecast now as opposed to that other range of prices, if you use the prices that are in the most recent oil price forecast, wouldn't that affect the payout from this fund somewhat significantly?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, if we were using a deterministic model, that would impact it. But because we're not, we're using the probabilistic model, we are still within the range of forecasted prices, even if we're at the lower end of the range. And so currently at the lower end of the range. And so the data points that we publish in the revenue sources book are based on that same probabilistic modeling that went into the model, except we selected a lower set of data points for purposes of the revenue sources book, but they're still within that range. So it really is the difference between a probabilistic look at the world that takes into account variability and a look at the world where we have to say, okay, if it was our best guess right now, this is what we think it's going to be. But that's not the way the world works. And so that's why you use the probabilistic modeling for forecasting variable, these things that have this wide variations in rates. Really two different perspectives on a set of numbers.
May I add a quick comment, Mr. Yeah. Chairman? I just think it does show you the advantage of using a probabilistic model, that you're not tied to making adjustments every time the price of oil goes up or down, but you're really recognizing right from the start that, yes, it could go to 30, but it could also go to 120. And what we've seen in oil prices is, if there's anything we know about them, is that they go up and down, and that they probably will go up and down again. Over what time period, we don't quite know. And, again, remember, there is this ability in the model to take a look every 4 years and to see, okay, do we need to make a change now? But this kind of modeling, you really don't want to be making changes, you know, every quarter or even every 6 months. You want to try to build a model that gives you that stability and takes into account the uncertainty.
Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
I guess I'd be curious to see what the payout would be using the price forecast from the spring sources book, unless that's just not a meaningful forecast, but that's the one the administration's provided. So I would like to see that. But let me just go to the next one. Through the chair, yeah, assuming the prices that you have in your forecast, my last recollection was that after you paid your guaranteed dividend amount the first couple of years, my last recollection was at these prices, you were talking a dividend that was more in the $500 range. And what would the dividend be by year three, assuming your oil price forecast in the spring forecast?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, would be in that $450 to $500 range.
Again, Representative Garrett?
For now, the next would be a comment, so I'm okay.
Representative Wilson, followed by Vice Chair Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if I go back to page 2, and it talks about the state modeling proposes that a $3.3 billion draw should be sustainable. So is that talking about that our budget should be down to $3.3 billion, so therefore it would be covered? What's exactly sustainable in that?
No. In Mr. Chairman, may I respond? No, it's not. I want to make it very clear. We're not trying to assess what the budget should be. That's obviously up to the government of Alaska and the people of Alaska. What we're saying is that the $3.3 billion is sustainable, we believe, in the long run, and that amount can then be available for the budget and whether and used as you see fit.
Follow-up?
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the models that you were referring to, Norway and the others, seem to have both sustainability about where we were going to get the funds from as well as kind of a better word of spending cap. So where is the spending cap as part of this model?
This model does not have a spending cap. That's not included in the model. The model is really designed to figure out what could be. If you wanted to have a stable flow of funds from the sovereign wealth fund that you have with the oil revenues and the returns, if you wanted a stable amount to come into the budget process, what would that be and what would be the assumptions that went into that and would those hang together? Having a spending cap or something else, that would be a different matter of policy and not something we comment on here.
A follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson.
So if I understand how our permit fund works now and our permit fund earnings, we already have that mechanism now. I mean, it all spins out. It goes into the earning reserve. If we want, as a policy, we can take out a set amount of money, just like it says here, and add it to our oil revenue, although it doesn't go in there, and still get to the same point. Is that not true?
Let me take that one.
Yes, why don't you? I think that's your bailiwick.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. By commingling the oil and gas revenue, tax revenue, royalty revenue with the earnings within the earnings reserve, you essentially allow yourself to, in years of low revenue, to draw a little bit more than you're putting in. And in years of high revenue, you replenish the fund and draw a little bit less than you could put in. If you just simply took a draw from the earnings reserve and added it to your oil revenue, where this year that's essentially zero, then you're going to be, you know, you would have substantially less available this year than you would under this fund, where you're actually looking at it over a 40 or over a 25-year period of time versus a single year. So by looking at it over the longer period of time, you allow yourself the opportunity in low revenues to draw a little bit more, and in high revenue years you replenish it. And we're in a low revenue year right now, and so you would have substantially less to spend this year doing it if you just added the earnings reserve to the oil and gas tax revenue that you'll receive this year.
And a final question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
So with this model, we are in no way touching the corpus of the permit fund. We are only touching what now goes into the earnings plus our oil revenue that we're putting into the earnings. But the corpus itself, we are not touching in any fashion.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler, you're next.
Thank you. Goodness. Well, Mr. Bailey, you're providing us an analysis of the model, so it's more technical than the policy, and it's been a long time since probability and statistics, so I can't challenge you on anything that the model says, but we can challenge some of the assumptions. I don't know if anyone here could. So actually, I want to follow up real quick on Representative Wilson's question. So I think as I understand things, Mr. Commissioner Hoffbeck, we can make our calculations and withdraw money from the earnings reserve according to whatever model we have here without any necessary replumbing the permanent fund. I think that's your point. I often hear her ask the question, is it necessary to put in statute? And I don't see where it's necessary. We could make the calculations envisioned by this model, make the appropriations a little bit more in low years, a little bit more in high years, whatever, but we could do that with current law, could we not?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, you could make that same calculation without the Permanent Fund Protection Act. What the Permanent Fund Protection Act provides is kind of this rules-based process that's ongoing, and so that you don't have this ad hoc withdrawal.
We would be assuming.
Sadler.
Thank you. Just follow up on that. We would be imposing our own rules on ourselves under either method. Okay. My question is. In examining one of the assumptions, you say that the production decline, I guess, is a steady straight line state on page 18. Production volume continues down deterministically at a steady rate. I don't know, based on what I understand about the physics and technology of the pipeline, that it's reasonable to assume that pipeline flow in Alaska will continue on a steady downstream to 117,000 barrels a day to 2040. I guess kind of probe that. Have you not considered the technical challenges of going below 300,000?
To the chair, Mr. Sadler, We did actually think about that. It's my understanding that there are technical difficulties if the flow falls below a certain level, and so I'm not sure that those would be insuperable. You would have to find ways around if the flow dropped that low. Now, obviously, if it turns out that oil production is higher than is forecast in this model, then that's something that is all to the benefit and makes everything more sustainable and better off. But, yes, I understand there are technical challenges. I'm not an engineer, and I wouldn't want to challenge you on that.
Nor am I.
Thank
you. And to probe that point again, so given our current net profits-based taxation system, I think if there were additional investments necessary to maintain oil flow, that would change the net of our tax revenue and therefore change some of the model's assumptions about oil income, which would kind of send things cattywampus. I don't know to what degree. Second question, the permanent fund returns currently assume the current investment guidelines, which is for long-term capital growth, and I forget what slide this is, 21. Says that the sovereign wealth proposal would shift to more pension-like strategy for investment, which means more fixed investments, assuming less risk and therefore less return. Doesn't that, to some degree, cloud the model's conclusions that but on the one hand, you're counting on the current permanent fund investment strategy returns, but then saying to change the purpose of the fund would require change in investment strategy. Do you see where I'm going with this dichotomy, consistency?
To the chair, Mr. Sadler, the slide may or may not be clear about this, but I think the actual basis for this is that if you had a more stable funding process, in other words, if you had a stable draw every year, that the permanent fund and the investment investors of the permanent fund would find it easier, actually, to have more returns, not less returns. Obviously, they would have to have some liquidity that was available to be moved into the earnings reserve, which is true now, but it wouldn't be unpredictable. And I think they could actually manage their investment funds in a way that was more systematic, and our estimate is they could perhaps even earn higher returns on the funds if this plan was put into effect. But I want to be careful. We did not do a specific analysis of their investment strategy. That is just our sense that if you had more stability in the outflows, they would be able to manage in a way that was more efficient and had higher returns.
I comment and then the question. I would be a little...
Sadler?
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm a little cautious about setting up that we do have a specific amount that the model indicates we should be able to draw, which might begin to affect the investment strategy, kind of going back up against the chain. Right now, we have a very independent permanent fund board of directors. They've determined investment strategy. We're not using the permanent fund for much except dividends and capital protection. If we change the permanent fund, as is envisioned by this initiative, that might tend to influence the investment strategy, and appointments to the board could also affect that strategy. That's a bit of a concern. Last question is, you are assuming, I think, a 2.25% annual inflation rate, which is historic. Given that we have a rather large national deficit, and it might become a matter of national policy to repay that deficit with inflated dollars, to what degree have you modeled other consumer price index inflation rates?
Through the chair, Mr. Sadler, we did not model different inflation rates. I have to admit this may be a little of a Washington perspective rather than Juneau-Alaska perspective, but in Washington everybody's worried about the fact that inflation is too low and they can't get it to 2%, which is what the Federal Reserve wants to get it to. The Federal Reserve's target, and the Federal Reserve is independent and controls monetary policy, and they are trying to their target is to hit 2% and not to have it too much below or too much above. So 2.25 would be actually a little bit above the Fed's current target. I appreciate we do have a very large deficit, but I don't think our Federal Reserve is going to inflate the dollar just to deal with that. That's going to have something that the federal government's going to have to deal with.
And last comment, having purchased many CDs at 15, 14% back in the 80s, I know it can go that high.
Oh, it certainly can. Excuse me. Yes, it certainly can.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is on the dividend and the calculation that is proposed under this model for the dividend, which is 50% of the royalty share. If we were to assume that 50% went to the corpus and kept the same calculation that we have now for the permanent fund dividend, which is tied to the earning power of the corpus of the account over a five-year average, what would the impact on this model be if we kept the same calculation? And what would the impact be if we changed that calculation to, instead of a 21% average, possibly a 10% average, but keeping it tied to the earning power of the corpus?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, I'll take that just because McKinsey didn't do any of the work associated with alternatives. They just looked at the one. So two parts to your question. First was, what would be the impact? In this case, on the sustainable draw, it would go from paying out about $700 million to about $1.4 billion each year. That would impact the sustainable draw by about $400 million per year, just rough numbers. So rather than being able to draw 3.3, you draw 2.9. The other issue, though, that we would point out is that maintaining an earnings-based dividend is pretty undesirable policy when you're also using earnings reserve revenues to go to the general fund, because a dividend calculated on earnings is highly variable. As we all know, we get our dividend checks. It can be 800, then it can be 2,000, then it can be 1,300. All that variability just reflects that five-year average of the portfolio performance and the statutory earnings. But the problem is every time the dividend jumps up, that means the share that goes to the government under any kind of endowment model will go down, just like when the dividend goes down, the share of money that goes to the government would go up. And there's really no reason that you would adopt a PMOV system or you would adopt the governor system where you would take this kind of set amount that you're taking out of the permanent fund, but then make the dividend part of that amount, but have a dividend that jumps all over the place. Because then what you're doing is you're telling the government that you have to do your budget on this very variable dividend calculation that's jumping all over the place. So sort of the better way to do a dividend, if you want to do something that's market-based, is you pay out your dividend on a percentage of the market value of the fund versus on its earnings year to year, because the value of the fund is relatively stable, whereas the earnings themselves are highly volatile.
Each time that we change speakers up here, would you please identify yourselves? That was Attorney General Richards. To make sure that our secretary gets who's made what comment correctly, please.
Okay, but Mr. Chairman, for clarity, then it would be a $400 million reduction if we kept the current calculation. And if we changed that calculation, it would be higher than that.
Actually, Representative Muno, now that I said that, it would actually be a little higher. I'll follow up with you with the exact number. But the current, I'll tell you what I do know, because I've seen the math on this. The governor has proposed, obviously, in this bill, the dividend based upon 50% royalties. We've also circulated a letter or two, including one from the governor's office, where he said there are other reasonable ways to calculate the dividend, and anything about $1,000 is reasonable, and there are several different ways to do it. If you go from the royalty-based dividend to one that is just a flat $1,000, that reduces the draw by $200 million. I've seen the numbers on that. So that means you go from $3.3 to $3.1 billion draw. Now, if you're going to keep the current dividend, which is roughly double but with some volatility, that's why I said $400 million, because I'm doubling that number in my head. But I'll get you the exact numbers to make sure it's right.
Okay, and then just one final question. The model assumes a $3.3 billion draw, but it also assumes that we have continued tax revenue from existing taxes of about $850 million. Is that correct?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, no. That's not correct in the sense of the $800 million. What it assumes is that over time, those revenues will be highly variable. Some years they'll be very, very high when oil prices go up, and some years they'll be very, very low. So all it does assume that those petroleum revenues, production taxes, and royalties will be in the permanent fund, but it doesn't make any given assumption about how much they will produce in any given year.
Through the chair. Just to clarify, I think the question that, Representative Munoz asked, there is yes, about $800 million worth of other taxes that are non-oil and gas taxes that flow in that would be available for government spending. And those were not put into the earnings reserve quite simply because they aren't very volatile. They're pretty steady. And so they didn't need to be put in there to reduce the volatility. So they still remain outside the model of the earnings reserve.
Okay, so then for the record, then 4.285 is the total that we would bring in with existing revenues and this new model for government spending.
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, on an average year, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 5, in your overview, you talk about what's in the scope and what's not in the scope. Seems like there's considerable things left out. I know modeling can only go so far, but you didn't recommend or talk about any other alternative modeling to proof your assumptions, or did you do that?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, no. We looked at this model. There were suggestions made to change this model, and certainly we are very experienced in applying models of this kind in sovereign wealth fund situations, but this was the model that we looked at, this one.
Okay. So did you...
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, did you do any... You did the Monte Carlo stuff so that you did the extremes on both ends and randomness, but did you try and crash it? Did you work on crashing it to see what would make it not work?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, yes is the answer to that, because whenever you create a model like this in which oil prices can go very high or very low, and when earnings could go very high and very low, and you could get a combination of very low earnings together with very low oil prices, and that is certainly an outcome that can be that's incorporated in this model. It's not necessarily got the high probability, but it's there, and it gives, in, as you saw in those charts, some fairly wide outcomes as you go out to 2040. In a way, this kind of model builds in the possibility that you might have a crash or something like that. Plus, keep in mind that because of the 4-year review that you're able to do, if you're looking at a situation where because you've had a bunch of bad years in a row, there's a danger that you're going to crash the earnings reserve, then you have the flexibility to make adjustments before it actually happens. But yes, I think this is really intrinsic to this is that you are trying to allow for things that might crash it. Now, if we had another Great Depression, could something happen that would be outside this model? That's possible, but this model is pretty robust. After all, we did have the worst recession in any recent times in 2008, 2009, and the outcomes for that period would fit quite within this model, would be certainly, if we had another situation like that again, this model would be robust, we feel, to such a situation.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Well,
my concern is, and I'm sure everybody's here concern is, we've done a lot of modeling on taxes, and we thought we would never be here. You know, with the price of oil from just a few years ago, over 100, now we're less than a third of that. So we have some concerns all around the table on modelings that will break or situations outside of the norm, which we're here we are right now. So thank you.
Representative Edgman.
I support a concept of this nature going forward. I think it's inevitable that we have to have this in place. One quick observation is it really appears like we're shifting the volatility from the general fund draw or the money that we get for government. We're shifting it to the permanent fund. by changing the funding source for the permanent fund itself, and I think there's going to be a fair amount of objection to that. But I'd like to hear your comments as to whether I sort of bluntly characterize that properly.
Through the chair, Representative Edgeman, I don't believe that's the way the model is constructed, because it's set up to preserve the value of the fund. So that was part of the key criterion that was used. And then we have to preserve the sufficiency of the earnings reserve. So I don't think the model itself is undermining the permanent fund. I would not characterize it that way. Do you want to say more?
So, Representative Edgeman, through the chair, if you don't mind. I mean, Attorney General Craig Richards. So I would agree in the sense that we're not shifting the long-term risk, we're shifting the short-term volatility, just as you said. And in fact, in some ways, that was the goal. Right? It's like the way I think about it is if you have two family incomes, one is, one parent is a gambler and the other one has a salary. Do you want to live off the salary or do you want to live off the gambler's income? And what we've been doing is we've been living off the gambler's income and we've been saving our salary. By putting the volatility in the permanent fund, you don't harm its long-term growth, just the short-term ups and downs, but you take all of the instability of year-to-year oil price volatility out of the year-to-year budgeting exercise for the state. So it's like changing the way the state is doing its finances so it's living off the salary rather than living off the gambler's income.
Representative Edgeman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I guess I get that, but on the other hand, when I look at the permanent fund being supported by royalty monies, is that right, which are drawn from a declining oil productions and ever-volatile oil prices, and who knows if the future landscape has low oil prices for a period of time. It seems to me it gives me less assurance that we would have maybe a smaller but more stable permanent fund into the future, but something that I can say to my constituents, we're going to reduce it to $1,000 or $1,100 or whatever it might be, but I can tell you in this new structure it's going to be a lot more consistent in terms of its availability vis-a-vis continuing to fully fund a $2,072 dividend like we have today that may be gone in a few years. So, I mean, that's kind of where I'm at intuitively with all this, and as I said in our earlier meetings, and I checked my notes, it was February 26th, so it's almost 2 months, a month and a half ago. It's been a while. I need to be able to explain this in a pretty concise way, so thank you.
May I make a comment through the chair?
Mr. Bailey.
I think that the design or the intent really of setting up this fund in the first place was to say there is this oil. It may not last forever, but we want to create a sovereign wealth fund which allows for the benefits of this oil to be there for in perpetuity. So, while there's plenty of oil, or if you happen to have an oil price, then you can draw most of the monies coming from that. But gradually over time, as the oil production declines, you're going to be more reliant on the earnings that are actually generated by the fund itself. And at this point, it's a big fund, and it's generating strong earnings. And so that, in a sense, is you're able to rely more on that, if you like, the worker with the salary in order to provide the funding.
All right, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, I would like to scope again what your mission is, Mr. Bailey. Your job is to evaluate the assumptions and the calculations built into this model and tell us if they're valid and reliable and to what degree they're reliable. It's not to comment on the wisdom of the policy or the appropriateness. So it's got to be a little – we're policy people, and so that's a little interesting for us. Let me ask you a question. Does the fact that this basically the rules, we've heard a lot about rule-based systems, does it concern you that the rules can be reset or rewritten or rejiggered every 4 years? Does that raise any questions in your mind about the stability of the long-term model?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, if we were looking at some countries or something like that where, politicians are all over the place, obviously you're concerned that if you have the discretion every 4 years to revisit, maybe they'll do something that will undermine the rules. But I think in a state like yours that you understand what's really necessary to get stability here, I think creating this system really does give you the opportunity to have that stable funding. You have to have an out, in a sense. You can't just put it on autopilot. You have to revisit it every 4 years. There's no way of not doing that, because you have to make sure that the assumptions that you put in, which may have been the best assumptions you had on the information you had at the time, you may have to revisit. So, well, yes, under certain circumstances, I suppose having the four-year revisitation might be a danger. But here, I think it's essential, and I don't view it as a particular danger.
I would comment that you only have to look at our oil tax policy to know that we are, if nothing, if not flexible.
Representative Wilson.
Okay, so the corpus is protected now. The corpus is protected underneath this plan. But what I see this plan doing, the reason we made it stable, or this is stable, is because we're taking people's dividends. I mean, that really is the bottom line. Right now, we have a process in which the calculation is for a dividend based on the earnings of the oil revenue that was put into the permit fund as another way to pay people back for the resources that they don't own, because it's, you know, the state owns those kind of resources. So the only the way I see that this does, it just really is stabilizing on the back of people, so that they're going to receive less than what they currently do, which, if that's what we want to do, which is not what I want to do, can it be achieved underneath the, you know, percent of market value plan that we've seen, or using the earnings reserve, not putting back the inflation? So correct me if I'm wrong, but this really is based on telling people that you're not going to get as much of the resources you thought you should receive if we go to this model.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. A couple of points here. It's more than the size of the dividend that generates the revenue. It's also the idea of this long-term balancing of the funds that are available, so that on a low year like this, you get some benefit from the long-term balancing. Is the dividend smaller under this plan than it was last year? Yes, it is. It's a different formula for calculating the dividend. But recognize that there is no dollar amount that defines the dividend. The dividend right now is a formula. It's always been a formula. And it's fluctuated tremendously. I think I said last time I was here, in the last 12 years, it's been below $1,000 four times, $1,000 to $1,500 four times, $1,500, above $1,500 four times. It fluctuates. This particular dividend program that's within the Permanent Fund Protection Act would be a substantially lower dividend. We've recognized through the various hearing processes that may be something that needs to be adjusted. And so we put some solutions out there that could look at various other ways of calculating the dividend. That would put it more in the $1,000 range on a given year, and which is close to the long-term average. And so we recognize that. The only thing that we all need to recognize is there's only so much money that's being generated through this system. So the larger the dividend, the smaller the amount that's there for government services. We recognize that's a balance. And so, the plan we put together in low revenue year, low oil price years, would be a fairly low dividend. The idea would be tracking with the economy of the state of Alaska. When the economy of the state of Alaska was healthy, dividends would be high. When the economy was in difficult straits, the dividend would be low. There's other opinions on how that should work, and we're open to them. You know, we aren't locked into this particular dividend formula. Just recognize when we select what dividend formula we're going to use, we have to adjust everything accordingly.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
So this is about more than just the dividend. I mean, your modeling is showing that, I mean, we still have a high amount of oil money that we got, or a low amount. I mean, that's in your plan or the way it is right now. You're just putting it somewhere else. You're putting it in for the earnings reserve versus over here in the general fund in a different pot of money. I mean, if we had a graph, it would just show different pockets of money going somewhere else. But this is really all based on a lower amount of dividend to make it work. And what this modeling isn't showing is, if we lower the amount of the dividend, what kind of financial impacts does that have to the state? Where are we going to still, like you said before, we're going to have to, as Representative Munoz says, you know, this doesn't take care of our budget problem. We still have to have other taxes and what those look like and how that impacts. So I guess I would have hoped that the modeling would have done more than does this model show sustainability? Well, yeah, you're putting all your money in one basket over here. You're formulating a different way it comes out. But what it doesn't show, in my opinion, is the impact to our economy, to the people who have counted on doing, you know, having a set dividend based on a totally different formula. Because, and this may be the political part of it, is what do we owe people for their resource of the oil? Because that's really what we're messing with here.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, again, there's more to it than just the dividend piece. There are other aspects that are generating the 3.3. In fact, the dividend under our model is essentially a pass-through. It's not really modeled. The model gets us to 3.3. The 50% of the royalty flows into the earnings reserve and right back out. So it really isn't even structured within this 3.3 model. It's just a flow-through. Comment that you made that now I'm forgetting what it was. So,
I guess the bottom line is I don't understand what's different. I understand the same revenue that we all, I mean, none of the revenue changes unless I'm missing something. We still have money that comes to the earnings reserve out of the corpus. We still have oil revenue that comes over here. We're just putting it together. The biggest factor in this is how big, I know it's not just about the dividend, but what really gives you the extra money is a lower dividend for our constituents.
And, through the chair, Representative Wilson, there's three things that change the math here in the short term. That is the size of the dividend, what cuts are made to government spending, and what new revenues can be generated. Those are the three that change the math. You're right. The rest is just which pot of money that we're spending out of in any given year. But this one does have the other effect, which is when you look at that spending over a longer period of time, you can actually take some of the variability out of how much you spend in a given year. But you're right. The math is those three. Those are the three things that change the math. How much you're going to spend, what new revenues do you bring in, and what's the size of the dividend.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson through the chair. So it's not, that is true in the long term. It is not true in the short term in the sense of it's all the same money. Because let me use the example of the earnings reserve itself. So let's say we went to a straight percentage of market value system, just plain old PMV like we normally think about it. Now, no one is saying that if we're going to use the earnings reserve, that we should get rid of the earnings reserve and we should budget the government off of statutory net earnings. And the reason is because statutory net earnings are so volatile. Some years they're $1 billion, some years they're $3 billion, and it actually occurs very regularly that you have that difference. So instead, what a percentage of market value does is it says we're not gonna, you know, budget to government and dividends based upon this highly volatile year-to-year earnings. Instead, we're going to take a percentage value of the fund, and we're going to use that to fund government and dividends. So it's a way of encapsulating the volatility of the earnings or the permanent fund. What this plan does is it does the same thing for your production taxes and your royalties. So although in the long term, no different amount of cash is coming in, what it does do for your petroleum revenues is it requires savings in high years, and then you can spend more in the low years. It takes this variable petroleum revenues to jump up and then jump down, and it smooths the line and kind of spins on an even basis through the middle of the collections year to year.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
yes,
respectfully, I am. What this does, what I see, is it changes the size of the dividend. It lowers it substantially. We have to still count on taxes to the same people we're going to give less money to in hopes that we'll make cuts that we need to, that all this will work with no guarantee in any of that. So, and just so you know, POMB, not in favor of that one either.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to say something that's going to require that we have David Teal here at some point. He ran through some models just on POMB, and I'm not saying this is the right number, but you know, let's say the public was comfortable with a $1,250 dividend. His model showed with a POMV process, you would extend savings for, you know, roughly a decade, as I recall, and we get to see in a couple of years what's happened to oil prices, and we get to be more flexible that way. But let me just go to your plan. Right now, the projections on the dividend are high dividends now, right? So the projections are they're going to be, what from what I've seen, $1,800, $2,000 over the next few years. And I want to put this in the context of what Dr. Knapp has told us in terms of job losses. If we maintain the current formula and for the dividend, just for reference for Dr. Knapp's analysis, you're putting about $1.2 billion into the dividend a year for an $1,800 dividend. That's a dividend based on the earnings of the permanent fund, which is what we do now. But you're proposing a dividend based on oil revenue. And if your forecasts are right, in a couple of years, if we're at $40, $45 oil prices, we're talking a dividend of about $400 or that's about $280 million. It's about a $900 million difference in the dividend, and according to Dr. Knapp, that's about 9,000 jobs, about 900 jobs you lose per every $100 million you lose in the dividend. That's a concern I have, so I guess I'll let you address that, going from this earnings-based dividend, which the British – I've seen projections. They say $1,800, $2,000. Obviously, the stock market can change. And then if we go to oil price forecasts of $40, $45, we're looking at about $900 million less than the dividend. I've been one to sort of side with the governor's level of cuts to the budget to try and prevent, in part, to try and prevent the job losses. But now we get them with this big change in the dividend, possibly.
To the chair, Representative Gehr, I think if you look at Professor Knapp's entirety of his report, essentially everything we do to close this gap is going to impact the economy. Not the dividend reduction has impacts, as do cuts in government spending, as do new taxes and new revenues. They each have an impact. And so if you simply say, well, if we need to leave the dividend in place, that saves 9,000 jobs, but you still have to make up that $900 million someplace using your numbers, you're either going to have to cut more or you're going to have to raise more revenues, and each of those will also impact jobs. So the net difference between the various choices is not that large. It really is just which choice that you intend to make. As far as with the policy, the choice that to be made, the other thing is that I wasn't here for David Teal's presentation, but the reducing the size of the dividend could extend the length of our savings in terms of months, maybe a year. It's not going to change. It's not going to allow our savings to last a decade. We're still in that 4 to 5 year range, regardless.
Through the chair.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with part of what you said, though. Dr. Knapp said of the revenue measures, the cutting the dividend has the biggest impact on jobs. Others have an impact too, according to his analysis. And then budget cuts have an impact. Let me just go ask you the basic how you get to $3.3 billion in revenue. So you're basing this on a $53 billion permanent fund and then $3 billion more from the CBR, so roughly $56 billion. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Gary, I think $55 billion was what our starting number was.
And through the chair, just a... So 4.5% of $55 billion is about $2.5 billion. And just help me add up where the other $800 million comes from.
Through the chair, it's oil and gas tax revenue, and then it's the long-term look rather than short-term. We're obviously in a low revenue year on oil and gas tax, but we don't expect that we will always be there. And so it looks at, using the Monte Carlo, it looks at that there's high years and low years throughout the 25 years of the modeling. And so it's taking that into account.
Through the chair.
Representative Gera.
So I think I misunderstood that. I thought the production taxes went into the permanent fund under your plan.
through the chair, Representative Guerra, they do. But the 3.3 isn't a snapshot of FY17, what's available. It's a look at FY17 to FY40. And with the volatility throughout that whole process allows for 3.3 across that period of time.
Through the chair. But if we're concerned about this coming year, you've got $2.4-ish billion coming out of the sovereign wealth fund, and there's no production taxes to add on top of it because those are all going into the sovereign wealth fund. So in FY17, is it a $2.4 billion spinoff, not a $3.3 billion spinoff?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, no, it's 3.3. And the reason being is that we modeled it across the 25 years, and we said we can draw 3.3 every year through the 25 years of the modeling. And with the various tests that were shown, that we still have better than 50% chance of the growth in the fund meeting inflation, and through at least the first 5 or 6 years, 100% chance that we won't draw down the earnings reserve with that 3.3 draw, and that it tapers off over time if we don't use the 4-year recalculation. And so the underpinning of this is that in good years, you put more money back into the fund. You don't spend everything you could. In bad years, you're allowed to spend a little more than is actually would be available in that given year. And it's over time, the high years and the low years balance out to that $3.3 billion draw.
Just a double question.
Follow-up, Representative Guerra.
I can ask you two questions in one. So we're not doing a 4.5% draw from this fund, or else we'd only draw $2.4 billion. We're drawing a lot more. And that's based on this expectation of future oil revenues. But if you used your price forecast and your oil revenue forecast for the next 10 years, those numbers don't get us there. So we're not using those forecast numbers?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, we are not using those deterministic numbers, those price point numbers for the model. We're using the probabilistic modeling, the idea that there will be variable oil and gas revenues throughout the life of this. But in order for us to publish something for the legislature to use for budgeting, we had to pick a specific number within that range of variable numbers. And so one is a deterministic look at it, one is a probabilistic look. The model is probabilistic.
Okay, sure. Moving on. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I think, Mr. Chair, I think I understand what you're saying, and maybe to offer some illumination, it's kind of a false precision to say that the $3.3 billion would come specifically from 4.5% of whatever, $5 billion. You're just saying that over time it would come out okay, and it's. I was a little concerned when I saw. I thought you were double counting the oil taxes and royalties too, but that's not the case. You're saying consider it all a big lump sum, and over time that's the amount. It's not an individual calculation exactly 4.5% each year. So
correct.
I think I got that.
All right,
Representative Thompson, if I might. Representative Sadler
Richards.
Through the chair. Another way to think about this, just because we all need one more layer of complexity, is that you don't have to think about $3.3 billion in the governor's plan alone. The governor's plan works as a percentage of market value. The percentage of market value for the governor's plan is 6% rather than 4.5%, because that 1.5% difference is basically accounting for the petroleum revenues. So you could have a fixed draw of $3.3 billion, or you can have a percentage of market value draw of 6%, and as long as the petroleum revenues are flowing into the permanent fund, the math works out about the same.
Through the chair,
Representative Sadler.
Mr. Chair, you're not suggesting that there isn't, you're just saying that's another way to look at it. You're not suggesting there's an alternate calculation that the governor's proposing, a POMV base. You're just saying that if you were to look at it that way and assume a 6% rate.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, actually the letter that we circulated, I think, late last week, actually did propose that the administration would be happy to work with this committee or anyone else if they wanted to do a 6% PMOV rather than a fixed $3.3 billion draw.
We get so many letters from the governor, it's hard to...
All right.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, this one was from Randy and I, so...
Okay, Attorney General Richards, Commissioner Hoffbeck, and Mr. Bailey, I want to thank you very much for being here today and for this presentation to try to help us understand the alternatives and what we are looking at and all of the possibilities. With that, the next House Finance Committee meeting will be today, April 5th at 5 p.m. At that meeting, we will be hearing House Bill 319, Snowmobile Registration Fees, House Bill 250, Individual Income Tax Credits and Returns, House Bill 249, Electronic Tax Returns and Motor Fuel Tax. And with that, at 3:17, we are adjourned.